Hello, and welcome to the Gavel Podcast, brought to you by the Pennsylvania Legislative Black Caucus. This podcast provides insightful discussions on legislative priorities, policy issues, and the fight for racial and social justice in Pennsylvania. My name is April Ash, and today we have with us State Representative Rick Krajewski of the 188th Legislative District of Philadelphia. How are you, Rick?
I'm doing well. That was such an official introduction. I was just like, I was just taking it in. I'm like, wow, this sounds so legit. I'm excited to be on here.
I mean, you are legit, you know, a trailblazer. I mean, you are a hot commodity right now.
Oh, okay.
You are doing big things. You're doing big things. And so we want to just highlight some of those things. First and foremost, right, in this peculiar climate that we are in, how are you holding up?
Yeah. I would say I'm doing okay. Obviously, this is a difficult time for all of us with what's happening on the federal level. But I have adopted a mindset of one, not getting too overwhelmed by what I cannot control, right? And the truth is I can't control what the Cheeto maniac wakes up and decides he wants to cut, you know, this morning. What I can control is my role as a legislator in this assembly and the policies and legislation that I can work on that's going to benefit Pennsylvanians. And that was the same work that I was going to do November 6th. It was the same work I was going to do November 7th. It's the same work I'm going to do on today of March 25th. And those are things that are under my purview. And those are the things that I'm going to stay grounded in and rooted in. And I'm excited to be able to have the support and the opportunity. You know, I'm privileged to be able to have an opportunity to still do something to benefit my community in a time of a lot of chaos. So I'm chilling.
I love that. I mean, and that, in this day and age, to your point, you know, with everything that is happening on the federal level, we have to stay grounded. And it's hard to do that, you know, so the fact that you're able to see the silver lining in everything, whether you are in control of it or not, you know, that speaks volume. So if you had to describe yourself as a movie title, what would it be and why?
As a movie title?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like an existing movie?
It could be existing, or you can make one up if you like.
Oh man. I mean, I like hot commodity, what you just said. Hot commodity? Like, okay, I'll take that.
Okay. We can do that. Yes. I mean, there's a lot of hot topics out there that you
there
are undertaking.
Lot of hot topics.
Yeah,
it's
that you're
true.
Undertaking. I mean, adult use cannabis.
Yeah.
You know, we could talk about voter ID all day long. You know, you also are championing the CARE package legislation actually going to get
justice.
Into right now.
Awesome.
You know, so as the Secretary of the Children and Youth Committee, you know, speaking of that hot commodity movie title, you know, we appreciate the CARE package legislation that
Great.
You have brought forth. And this is a package of 10 bills in which it is to reform Pennsylvania's juvenile justice system, right? So how does the CARE package legislation work to create those positive impacts for marginalized groups within Pennsylvania's juvenile justice system?
Yeah, 100%. And so just to give some background on the package. So there was a commission that was pulled together by the General Assembly to do a report and study on the issues with our juvenile justice system, which are many and widespread in terms of the way that our youth are traumatized and institutionalized and honestly just deeply harmed through a lot of our juvenile justice facilities, whether they're detention centers or treatment centers. And so because of these inadequacies, there were a lot of policy recommendations that came out of that report, that commission report. And so Representative Dan Miller, he initially introduced a bill, HB 1381, that was a broad encompassing juvenile justice bill that had everything from ending the prosecution of youth as adults to having better guidelines around detention of youth and also around diversion program accessibility for juveniles. And given that it was such a huge, weighty piece of legislation, For those of us who have been taking a leadership interest in this issue, decided to break it up into these 10 packages that are the care package. And so basically there are 10, and that's not, you know, obviously not all the issues that exist within our juvenile justice system or our justice system at large, but 10 of what we believe are some of the highest priority things that we as legislators can do to make our juvenile justice system in Pennsylvania as compassionate as possible, as streamlined as possible, as fair as possible, and mitigating the possibilities of causing long-term harm and trauma to young people that go through the system. And so I'm excited to be able to be working with Dan Miller, with fellow PLBC member Rep Rab, and Emily Kincaid, and a few others. Andre Carroll, I know, is also in the mix. Carol Kazim, of course, is a leader on this issue as well. I'm just excited to have partners where we can work on some pretty comprehensive legislation. And I have two bills as part of the package. One around greater access to diversion programs for adjudicated youth, and then another one for more guidelines around detention of youth.
I love what you said about having more programs surrounded for those children, because I mean, even down to just housing, right? That's even an issue. You know, sometimes these children are incarcerated and they're put into these juvenile detention centers, but they don't have enough room. They don't have enough education, yes, training, you know, programs in order to get them into that rehabilitative, you know, space in order for them to become more productive citizens, if you will, and have a better chance at a better quality of life. And so we can definitely appreciate, you know, the work that you're doing with that. And how many of those bills currently have been introduced and are actually moving through the House or even the Senate as it is for this legislative session year?
Yeah, so these 10 bills are all House bills currently. I'm not sure if we have companion legislation yet, but I think that's something we are interested in exploring. We right now have put out co-sponsorship memos for all of the 10 bills. We don't have introduced legislation yet, but we all do have like draft policy we're working on with stakeholders. And we've begun to introduce those memos since the press conference last week announcing the care package. Our goal is to use this legislative session both this year and next year to try to make some real progress on this myriad of issues through the package.
Yeah, and you know what? Even I think a part of that significant effort is preventing imprisonment for nonviolent offenses.
Yes.
Right? And that is a part of the bills that you actually, yes, are introducing, mm-hmm, right? So can you speak to how can the decriminalization of even marijuana or from a social equity business perspective help, how can this legislation help uplift marginalized communities while also benefiting the broader economy?
Yeah. So I think youth and the intersection of juvenile justice with youth and also criminalization of marijuana is a very important one, because, you know, a lot of kids end up getting caught up in the system because of, you know, whatever, having a little bit of weed or maybe even doing some sales of cannabis. And a lot of times, right, like these are youth who maybe their brother or their uncle or whoever else, you know, maybe sell a little bit of cannabis on the side. And so that's how they kind of got introduced to it. Or they want to have a little bit of pocket change, and this is an easy, simple way for them to kind of make a little money on the, mm-hmm, side. And then, you know, they get caught up and end up on this path to getting institutionalized. They end up at a detention center. And maybe because the detention center is overcrowded, or there's not enough beds, or there's not enough treatment centers, they have to stay longer and longer in the detention center before they actually undergo their education or treatment plan. And what that means is they have longer time in the system, which means they're more likely to come into conflict with into contact with folks who might pull them deeper and deeper into illicit activity. And so it kind of creates this cycle of recidivism, where the more you put someone into the system, the more likely they are to recidivate. And so our goal should be to get people out as much as we can. And I mean, honestly, with that interdisciplinary diversion programs are important, divert them from the system, period. You know, if you can just get them out, don't even put them in a detention center, maybe get them through some other programming or some other support issue, you know, something, some kind of community support function. That to me is the ultimate goal and something we should strive for as much as possible. And I think through decriminalizing cannabis, we eliminate one of those low hanging ways in which people start to enter the system in the institutionalization that then could put them on a path of further offending, further trauma, further harm. Which we know, obviously, of course, impacts our communities and our ability for our communities to become economically empowered. And so I think that by decriminalizing cannabis, it benefits our youth system because that's how a lot of kids get caught up.
No, that's very true. I mean, children as well as adults, right? Mm-hmm. So there's been a long history of mm-hmm. a war on drugs and, oh, yeah. you know, the criminalization of marginalized communities and black and brown folks being unlawfully at times, you know, criminalized for nonviolent small crimes, if you will. I don't want to call them petty, but small crimes. Yeah, but some of petty. Them can be petty.
Some are
you know?
Petty.
Yeah, some of them are. And so with that, you know, let's talk a little bit about adult use cannabis.
Sure.
That has been a hot topic for the past
That is a hot couple, commodity.
That is very much is a hot commodity. And you and State Representative Dan Frankel are championing this piece of legislation. Now, I know that a few folks, Senator Sharif Street has introduced legislation. State Representative Ahman Brown has introduced legislation. State Representative Emily Kincaid has legislation out there.
Everybody's got a bill.
Everybody's got a bill.
Yep.
So can you speak to what
Dave
DeLosso
has a bill.
Oh, yeah. You know, I totally forgot about that. That's right.
Uh-huh.
Can you speak to some of the main differences
sure.
between your bill and the other versions that may be out there currently?
Sure. So I would say top line, you know, I think we should all be excited because there's obviously a lot of interest, at least democratically, in legalizing cannabis. And that's a good thing because it's ridiculous that it's not legalized. We're basically surrounded by states that have legalized. It's far beyond time. Ohio, we got beat by Ohio.
Yeah.
We should be ashamed that Ohio beat us to legalizing cannabis. So obviously there's a lot of interest in focus on it. Our bill does a few things a little bit differently from some of the other proposals out there. One is, you know, and I'll just say, you know, my background and how I've gotten involved in this space is, so I sit on the health committee and I am the chair of the health committee subcommittee of healthcare. So a lot of health. Dan Frankel used the committee to host a series of hearings on recreational cannabis. We listened to industry stakeholders, to formerly incarcerated people, to business development people. We even had a hearing where we heard from Canada and other international models around recreational cannabis legalization. And so I think got a very broad array of experiences and feedback and thoughts about how to do this. And I'll say one, for me as someone who is a black legislator who comes from a community that's been impacted by the war on drugs and drug criminalization, and represents a district that is still wrestling from the war on drugs, that I believe as legislators, two of the things that we have the most direct control over is one, the ways in which we enact legislative policy around decriminalizing and legalizing cannabis and the ways that we use legislation to right the wrongs of criminalization of cannabis and how we use public dollars to go directly into communities that have been impacted by the war on drugs and specifically around the disproportionate enforcement and criminalization of cannabis, cannabis criminalization. Because that's what we have control over, right? We have control over our purse strings, and we have control over the laws that dictate what is legal and what is illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And so our bill is very aggressive on both of those fronts. We have a community reinvestment model that puts 60% of all proceeds from cannabis sales that come back to the Commonwealth, back to communities that have been impacted by the war on drugs. And those communities and municipalities can use that money for workforce development or for legal aid to help people who are seeking expungement or resentencing opportunities for their cannabis-related charge, for youth violence prevention, gun violence prevention. We can be very creative about how we use the money, but first and foremost, we got to make sure the money gets to the right people and to the right leaders to make an impact. And 60% is on par with any state that has legalized cannabis in terms of a community reinvestment fund that's putting the majority of its money back into those areas. So we wanted to make sure that we were leading the pack with everyone else in terms of how much money we funneled right back into areas and zip codes that have been impacted by this. Moving to the criminal justice element, we know this is a big thing. Obviously, we're just talking about it with juvenile cases, but especially with adult cases too. Cannabis charges and criminalization has led to, I'm sure untold hours of trauma and job loss and lost work hours, lost dollars to the economy. A lot of heartache and heartbreak for no good reason. And that still persists today because of the legacy of records, the way they impact abilities, the ability of people to access employment or housing or social benefits. And so we have to be very thorough around how we address those records, because it's still a scarlet letter on people's, you know, conscience and in their life today. And so our bill seeks to do that through a couple of different things, through obviously expungement of records, through having the ability for people to petition to have their record reviewed for eligibility of expungement. Because the thing that's tricky about Pennsylvania sentencing is, you know, obviously you have the charges that are, you know, possession of cannabis, possession with intent to distribute cannabis, et cetera. But you have other charges on the books that are kind of intent to distribute or sell that do not actually list the substance involved. Mm-hmm. It just says, you know, possession of a substance with intent to distribute or sell or whatever. And there are people who right now may be incarcerated or may have a record that has that kind of vague description, but it was cannabis related. And so those people won't get caught by automatic process. We need to let them know, hey, you have to come petition the courts to have your case reviewed, because it's not going to be picked up as a cannabis charge because it just says, you know, intent to whatever. So we want to have a system that's very thorough and expansive around catching those kind of edge cases. And we are crafting legislation to do that. The next thing we are working on that I think is what's really bold about this is we're also looking and exploring the idea of actually vacating charges, which actually goes a step beyond expungement. So expungement of a record, you know, is basically sealing it from public access. So employers can't view it. Other kind of background screening checks won't bring it up. But it is still technically a record in the system of the courts. It's just sealed around public access. Whereas vacating a charge is essentially erasing it as though it never happened. So it's even beyond a pardon. It's basically like this: you did not commit an offense. And this is actually we've been told, and I've come to learn that this is actually uniquely important in immigration cases, because the way federal law treats expungement or expunged records is different from state law. And so in state law, you know, you kind of have the box of like, have you ever been convicted, et cetera. And if you have an expunged record, you can say, no, I haven't. Federally, you would still have to say yes and say yes. Even if you had an expunged record, you would have to say, yes, I have been convicted of a record or of a charge related to cannabis or whatever.
Does that also relate to the, what is that called, the ARD program? Is that still like...
Oh, for like diversion
that, yeah, programs? Like, is that still, I think that's what it's called. Is it ARD? I have to double check that.
Well, with diversion, depending on the situation, with diversion cases, those should not result in a charge. Okay. So like those should also not be on your record, period. Okay. And you might have like a you know, history of, I'll have to look more. I'm not a lawyer.
No, fair enough.
So I don't want to also necessarily misquote, but I have been talking to a lot of lawyers. But my understanding is with diversion programs, they will get adjudicated outside of the courts and so don't result in a record. But with vacating specifically, this is important. I mean, one, for just clearing it whatsoever, but also in the context of immigrants who are now, you know, particularly vulnerable, this provides them another layer of protection around being exploited or what's the word I'm looking for? Just being targeted by the different people, bad people. And so those are two big things. And then the biggest thing that is also unique about our bill is the way we have structured the retail market. And I'll preface this, and I've done this preface about a million times now, so I'm hoping I have it down pat. So of course, you know, as a PLBC member and in talking with the PLBC and with community members, we know that social equity is important as part of legalizing cannabis. Because of the ways we've been criminalized, because of the ways that value and profit has been extracted from our communities, there's a lot of reparation that needs to be done as part of this process. And there are a lot of states that have attempted to do social equity primarily through the retail market and the involvement of dispensaries as part of recreational cannabis. And the truth is, April, is it's generally accepted that this has been a failure in every state that's tried to do this, primarily through the dispensary model. And there's a couple reasons for why that is, from my perspective. One is, and this is the challenge with legalizing cannabis, no matter what model you put out, is it's still federally illegal. And so, you know, any day the feds could come to any state and shut it all down, because technically every state that has legal cannabis is breaking federal law.
Shh, don't tell nobody.
Just keep it between us.
Okay.
And everyone else and everyone who's listening to this podcast.
We won't tell nobody else.
All right, no one else. But because of that, right, you are immediately, you're not going to get a lot of loans from banks or financial institutions, because they're not going to, that's a high risk loan. And so what you see again and again and again is the kind of people we are talking about when we're looking for social equity applicants are not the kind of people who have access to independent capital or independently wealthy. I mean, if they were, they'd be having some other business they would be running, and maybe they already do. And so they're not people who are necessarily the kind of folks we were thinking about when we're looking at the kind of entrepreneurs we want in this business, because you are blocked out from capital. And so what ends up happening, though, is some of those people who are the kind of folks we're thinking about, because they don't have access to capital, because they are not independently wealthy, end up having to partner with private equity or
multi-state,
capital,
or multi-state operators,
which are kind of more established industry players. Whether that's, you know, terms around incubating their business or providing a loan that might have a high interest rate because they're also taking a risk around supporting this business. And what you'll see happen is it's really hard to make money. To make money. One, because dispensaries are very expensive. They're multi-million dollar business products. Every state that has regulated cannabis has had a long process, because you're now taking a fully established medical, well, in a lot of states, they're existing medical, or at least at minimum an illicit market, and you're now transitioning that into a recreational market with regulations, laws, right, processes, public health things, all that. That takes years to fully scaffold up. Meanwhile, you're holding this bag of a $2 million loan with some crazy interest rate, and you might not make a profit until year two, year three.
True.
And what happens is people can't survive that long not making money, because they don't have any money, which is why they took the loan in the first place. And so a lot of times people will kind of, they'll fall into debt, they have to declare bankruptcy a lot, because sometimes they have to have the property up before they can start the dispensary, but then they still got to pay their rent on the property, but they can't start the business yet because of the regulatory rollout. And so it becomes this like trap where people are just caught in this system where they thought it was going to be one thing and the reality is a whole different thing.
We saw that with medical marijuana. That's exactly what we saw
with medical. What happened with medical.
Yeah. So it's like, what can we do differently this time around if we're going to legalize adult use?
Right.
Like, I know that in, I believe in your language, you have, you're establishing a social equity office to assist with those kinds of like grants and that type of assistance for social equity business. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we're going to be, to finish out kind of talking about the model. So the unique thing about Pennsylvania is that we have a state system around liquor, right?
Yeah.
Where we have a public entity through the Liquor Control Board that has experience, you know, selling a highly regulated product, purchasing wholesale amounts of that product, ensuring that minors don't have access to that product, which are all skills that are easily transferable to cannabis sales. And so our proposal, and I'll say the other thing, just on the kind of state of things, is, as you mentioned with medical, you know, we have this robust medical system in Pennsylvania already, where you have these operators who own the whole production from soup to nuts. They have the growing processing, they got the transportation system, they got the dispensaries, and those are people who are salivating to transition into recreational cannabis. And when it happens, they're done. They're done. They transfer and they're done. And they can immediately start selling on day one. And you're telling me that we're gonna have directly impacted person who's never started a dispensary, never done this kind of business, is gonna be able to compete against these big guys who have everything from the facility to the dispensary, who have no incentive to allow these people to sell their products because they have their own dispensaries. And so instead of falling into that kind of trap around trying to compete with this robust market, our goal is to have, we're calling it a hybrid model, is to have the ability for people to still enter the industry from growing to cultivation to transportation, and even to have on-site consumption in some small retail. So think of, you know, a coffee shop or somewhere we can buy cannabis baked goods, a lounge. We have all those opportunities, and then the primary source of retail would be through the creation of new state stores that would sell cannabis. And my belief is this is a realistic and balanced approach where we are still having opportunities for entrepreneurship and for social equity entrepreneurship, because everything on the private licensing side that's in the bill is giving priority to social equity applicants. Our bill will also have money from the community reinvestment portion set aside for small business development, whether that's someone who wants to enter the industry or not. And this, I think this is a way where we're realistic about the current state of recreational cannabis just in Pennsylvania and the United States. We're providing an entry point for people to still engage in this business. And we have a publicly accountable and stable system where we, again, still have opportunities. You know, we're not going to be growing or making weed. We will have the opportunity to contract out with social equity business owners who develop cannabis products to shelve at our state stores. We still have the opportunity to be very creative about how we do this, where we can provide opportunities for folks who've been impacted while having a publicly accountable process that would also boost the amount of money we would get from legalizing cannabis.
So one thing that you said that kind of just had my spidey senses going off, and I was like, yeah! Getting creative with the state stores and still prioritizing social equitable businesses to be able to have their product on the shelf? Because I think that that's like a major concern for social equity business, and rightfully so. We literally just talked about, you know, the MSO heavyweights, you know, in the medical side of it. So now moving into the adult use space of it, it's like, okay, are they going to have a fighting chance? Will they have a fighting chance? Because we understand about the financial space of it, but to know, it's comforting to know that there will be an office there to serve those businesses, to ensure that they get first round, you know, on the marketing, the transportation, the security, or the shelf lifing, the packaging, the labeling, you know, those things, even down to, like you said, now, will there be an opt-out for municipalities? Say if municipalities are like, they're like, I don't want this business in there. Will they be able to reap the benefits of that community reinvestment? Or how does that work?
So the community reinvestment is fully, that'll just be based on zip codes and analyses, and so municipalities and nonprofits can get that money no matter what. We will not be having, so we won't be having an opt-out for the actual state cannabis stores, because the truth is opt-out is a dangerous game around legalizing cannabis, because what you end up doing, and I get it, people want to have local control over this rollout, but what ends up happening is you actually create a kind of dangerous patchwork of some counties it's legal, some it's not. It makes it hard to enforce the legalization because you bounce between legal, illegal, and it's confusing for enforcement of legalization. It ends up allowing the illicit market to kind of like compete, because you're like, all right, like, County X has legal cannabis, but it's $20. I'm gonna sell it in 10 minutes across the county border for $10. And so you just end up kind of creating more of a headache if you don't have a standard around legalization statewide. But what we will have is with the consumption in the lounges, that licensing has to be approved by local municipalities. So they would have to approve they would have to do like a zoning approval to allow lounges and coffee shops and things like that to be able to start to scaffold up in their municipality. So there is some control there around giving people the opportunity to opt into the use of lounges.
Oh my gosh.
So it's more of an opt-in than an opt-out. You can opt in to, you know, we will have the retail through the cannabis state stores, and then you can also opt in to have fully private entrepreneurial opportunities around consumption lounges and other sort of, you know, you can consumption lounges, you can have, like, you know, I know folks have talked about like kind of like weed food trucks, you know, like there's a, you know,
New York gave us the model, because they got the treats and all kinds of stuff out there,
you know, baked goods, cannabis infused, you know, restaurants, like all of that is fair game.
Yes, it is. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to enlighten us and to speak with us today. I know that, again, like we said, you are a hot commodity. I see your picture everywhere. They're like, yes, we're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about that. So we appreciate that.
I keep myself busy.
Yes, as you, I mean.
Rick, hot commodity Krajewski.
But you know, but I like that though. I like that. And you know what? Rosa Parks said, you must never be fearful about what you are doing when it is right. Mm. And because you are doing the right thing, you know, it's not a bad thing to be everywhere where you need to be, because that's where you need to be. So we thank you so much for this candid conversation. And so that is another episode of The Gavel. We will see you the next time.